Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today.
Hello, OCD family community. I'm coming to you a bit tired after a week of weather-related e- and remote learning. Big changes, lots of politics, apparently some drama with Blake Lively, don't know, maybe you've heard of it, whether you care to or not. New fires in LA, I mean, it's a lot. But my sweet kiddos are at school today, and I'm happy to be here with you, and not them. Sorry, not sorry, kiddos. Love ya, but I needed a day. So I just want to acknowledge for anyone feeling battered and bruised by all the things, you're not alone. But hey, on a supportive and uplifting note, today we're chatting with Taylor Neuendorf, LCPC, about perfectionism. And while this definitely can and does show up in different OCD presentations, it also shows up outside of OCD. It shows up in life. But Taylor has written a super successful and actionable workbook on perfectionism, and he's here to share all about it with you, fam. So get comfy, because we've got some learning and thought-provoking discussion ahead, and I can't wait for you to hear more.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent, and let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
Alrighty, fam. Alrighty. So, on top of all the things this week, we had a couple of birthdays in the family, and I think somehow, hear me out, not sure, but this week has had approximately 17 days so far. Anybody with me? I mean, there's been good moments and hard moments, but it has been a lot. So I'm glad it's Friday, because not only does that mean the weekend is upon us, but I get to hang out with you. And for this week, Taylor. And honestly, Taylor, this episode has been a long time coming, hasn't it? For context, fam, we recorded this months ago, as you'll hear us reference later in the episode. And then I planned to publish this a couple weeks ago, but then LA caught on fire, and so did my brain. So we pivoted in real time to allow for some guidance and direction for managing mental health crises in the midst of real crises. And Taylor and I both used to live in the Golden State, otherwise known as California, so he's been beyond patient and flexible, another theme we'll chat about later in this episode. But I just want to take a moment to thank him for taking some time to share with you about the important and prevalent topic of perfectionism. So on that note, let me tell you a little bit more about Taylor, fam, and we'll get right into it. Taylor Neuendorf, LCPC, is a licensed clinical professional counselor in Illinois and the founder of Chicago Counseling Center PC, a group practice that specializes in the treatment of OCD and anxiety disorders. He is also the network clinical training director for the telehealth platform NoCD. Taylor is the author of the Perfectionism Workbook, Proven Strategies to End Procrastination, Accept Yourself and Achieve Your Goals. He lives in Chicago with his wife, three sons, and a new puppy named Chewy. So without further ado, fam, let's meet Taylor. Well, welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast, and I am thrilled to have a Midwesterner here, Taylor Neuendorf, LCPC, who has his own Chicago Counseling Center in the Chicagoland area, but is also an expert on perfectionism, has written a perfectionism workbook, and we're going to talk about all of that and more. But first, Taylor, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I truly am very, very happy to be here.
Thank you. And I'm happy to have you. You do training with NoCD, or as part of NoCD, which for any newer fam joining us, is online therapy app that specializes in exposure and response prevention and provides a lot of hope for virtual access to treatment in the US and beyond for OCD. And so I recently got to attend a training that Taylor facilitated on this very topic, on perfectionism. And I'm thrilled to have a dedicated conversation because I think this shows up a lot for people. And so we're going to get into all of that and more. But first, Taylor, I was telling you before we started recording, I'm just so fascinated by just the breadth of generosity and willingness for our professional community to share about what they've learned and gleaned and tips and strategies for the family here. And I'm so curious, when did you get into the OCD world? Have you treated it your entire career, or has this been something that drew you in?
I love that question. I'm always curious about how people got into our field, first of all, and also how they kind of found their way to helping people with OCD and helping their loved ones. I honestly just kind of stumbled upon it in two different ways. So when I started, you know, as a therapist, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I had some interest in working with substance abuse. And that was actually my first internship. I worked in an adolescent substance abuse recovery center. And shortly after that, started working in a behavioral health hospital in their eating disorder program. And what I started seeing, I didn't know this was potentially OCD at the time, but in working with those populations, for example, with the substance abuse, I would hear these teenagers talking about, you know, they would get like these really upsetting thoughts that they didn't want to be thinking about. I remember distinctly one kid would tell me about these really horrific images coming into his mind. And that is what was actually prompting his substance use. So people trying to cope, for lack of a better word, with any kind of intrusive, unwanted experiences by using substances and kind of numbing out and pushing that stuff out of their head. And once I was working with eating disorders, started to see a ton of crossover, definitely with anxiety in general, tons and tons of OCD. Oh, I just wanted to learn more about it because I was seeing it so much. And what I was also seeing was, quite frankly, like the people around me, my colleagues, all wonderful therapists, didn't really know much about OCD. And they were kind of constantly overlooking it or not even really addressing it as an issue for people. And as a result, we were seeing people not really get that much better, not making too much progress. I was always curious about it, wanted to learn more about it. And at the same time, one of my very dear friends from college divulged to me that she had just been diagnosed with OCD. But the way she described it to me, again, I never in a million years would have guessed it was OCD. And one of the reasons she went so long without getting a proper diagnosis, she was getting intrusive thoughts and images of doing harmful things to her family, her parents. And it scared the crap out of her, right? And she never would have guessed I was OCD. I wouldn't have guessed it either. But she told me that. So I started attending trainings on it. Very, very fortunate that shortly after I wanted to actually move in that direction in the behavioral hospital where I was already working, a position opened up in the OCD program that was literally down the hall. I just walked in and I was like, please, please, can I work with you? I want to learn more about this. Got the position and it's all I've been doing ever since. And that was probably 14 years ago.
I was going to say, is that in the Chicago area? Were you working in which treatment center?
So when I was working there, it's undergone a few different names. But at the time, it was Alexian Brothers Behavioral Health Hospital. They had numerous outpatient and inpatient programs for different conditions and behavioral issues.
Yeah.
Now it's part of Amita Health, and it's just outside of Chicago in the suburbs.
Yeah, so that would be then where Patrick McGrath was, and I'm guessing you guys know each other.
Oh, we know each other very well. Yeah, so I worked with Patrick at Alexian Brothers. He was, you know, fundamental in training me and helping me understand how to administer ERP for OCD and anxiety. I left after many years, opened my private practice, and then twist of fate, I started working at NoCD. And about a year after I'd been there, he ended up joining NoCD as well.
Yes, so. He's the chief clinical officer. So he's involved there. And it's interesting because the family here is familiar with Patrick. He's been on the show before talking about substance use disorder and has described the crossover with the substance use groups as well, the OCD group. So I'm not surprised there at all. Something that I've also learned, we had Dr. Jenna DeLossi on talking about eating disorders back in season one. And something that she talked about that was really interesting, and I find even with the referrals that I get for therapy, a lot of people with eating disorders saying, I think maybe we're struggling with OCD. There is a high comorbidity, meaning a co-occurrence between eating disorder and OCD, and in fact, eating disorder and mood disorders, period. But what's interesting and something that I learned from her is that a malnourished brain, even if you don't have OCD, a malnourished brain tends to exhibit an increase in obsessive compulsive symptoms. So even if it's due to an eating disorder, and any people listening that do therapy as a practice know, when we go through different diagnoses, we have to go, is it better accounted for by, say, something like substance use, by something like eating disorder? And so we have to consider that when we think about diagnosing OCD as well. But I learned if a brain gets nourished and OCD lessens or dissipates completely, then we know that that was the result of the eating disorder. If it doesn't, then we know that there's also that co-occurring OCD. But as far as treatment groups go, and just as you were describing, so I'm not shocked at all that you ended up in OCD, knowing that substance use and eating disorders were some of your past experience, because what we found even when it comes to ERP is that research shows it can be very effective for substance use, eating disorder, and OCD. And so that's really fascinating. So as you then started to specialize in OCD, what brought you to the subject of perfectionism? Because you've written the perfectionism workbook and you give trainings, I'm sure, on many topics, not just perfectionism. But what drew you to have the interest to write on this specifically and come up with this workbook?
Yeah, I think it was not too dissimilar from how I kind of came across OCD and just started seeing it more and more and became more curious about it and wanted to learn how to help people with it. It was the same thing with perfectionistic tendencies. Definitely once I was, you know, fully focused on OCD and working with a variety of anxiety disorders, I was just hearing people start to, you know, describe these perfectionistic belief systems that were kind of determining how they would act and certainly influencing how they were feeling day in and day out. And then again, started thinking back to people I had worked with in the eating disorder program and kind of recognizing in retrospect how their perfectionistic behaviors were really detrimental. I mean, in cases like causing them true physical harm, like putting them in harm's way as far as not just mental health, but physical health was. And then just trying to be a little introspective myself, I started thinking about myself and what I could relate to in what I was seeing in many of my clients. And I realized I'm totally a perfectionist and I never really knew it. And I never really thought about it or conceptualized it that way.
Yeah.
And what's funny is once I started learning more about it, really focusing on researching it, studying it, trying to find different ways to help people with it, and then published the Perfectionism Workbook, I had a few friends from college and high school reach out and they're like, hey, thanks for making me aware of a problem I never knew I had before. So once you learn more about it and everything that kind of gets wrapped up in perfectionism, a lot of people can relate.
Yeah, you can't unsee it once you're right. Like, the veil has dropped. I am a self-proclaimed recovering perfectionist. And, you know, perfectionism, what we will say, you know, the topic we're talking about in the context of OCD, and we're going to talk about it kind of broadly, but perfectionism, like you said, could show up in other areas as well. So if you're perfectionistic, it doesn't necessarily mean you have even a particular mental health disorder. It's not exclusive to OCD, but yeah, perfectionism runs rampant in a lot of disorders where a sense of control or a desire for some certainty in eating disorder and OCD in a number of different spaces. And then it can also be a personality characteristic that comes up and doesn't always meet, again, the threshold of a disordered level. It can, but there are different ways in which perfectionism can manifest. And so we're going to be discussing all of that today. And so I'm going to say, Taylor, to help us understand, first of all, when we're talking about perfectionism, what do we mean? How do you define that? And I'm sure it's broad and it depends on certain contexts, but let's start from there and help us understand.
Yeah, I love that you asked how we define it, because I always like to start with what are almost like dictionary definitions of some of these terms, because it helps us understand what it is about perfectionism that causes a lot of stress and disruption functioning for people. So literally, like, the dictionary definition of the word perfect is flawless, without a single flaw, mm-hmm. right? And then we're talking about perfectionism, especially if you start to look at it more like in the clinical context, it's this disposition to regard anything short of perfection as being unacceptable. So the way I always think about that, and I talk about it with my clients and whenever I'm trying to provide information on it to people, it's like, if you just stop and think about that for a minute, the disposition to regard anything short of perfection as unacceptable, and perfection itself is the state of being entirely without flaw or defect. Mm-hmm. It's an impossible standard, right? So for people who hold on to these perfectionistic beliefs that anything that is not completely flawless and without defect is unacceptable, you know, life through this lens that most things, if not everything, seems unacceptable, at least to some degree.
Right.
So that alone, like when I just think of that, I start to feel stress. Like I feel myself getting tense, and it gives me pause to really reflect on, you know, if that's kind of the viewpoint people are operating on.
Yeah.
Of course, they're going to feel unhappy, unsettled. Things are going to feel uncertain, and that causes more anxiety.
Well, and it's an interesting conversation, very relevant to now too, because we have, what is even perfection? You know, we have all these filters for life now, right? You know, even if we think of something like in social media, right? We have filters, or Snapchat, and you're just goofing off with friends, but you can put a filter on it. And there used to be more campaigns about what you see isn't reality because of Photoshop. And now we live in augmented reality where AI can create literally in real time a new version. And so it is this completely unattainable goal, even when we're thinking about that from a visual aspect, let alone writing, let alone the way we're thinking about things. And it can be very pervasive.
100%. Yeah. And I might have shared this in the training you attended, but I have a nephew now. He's in his early 20s and he's trying to date. And he's basically given up on dating apps because no matter who he goes out with, he's told me, like, they never once look anything like the picture or even pictures that they've posted on the app. And you can go on an AI app, you can snap a picture of yourself super quickly, and then you can completely manipulate it, your hairstyle, your hair color, like how your face looks,
right,
your entire wardrobe, like everything, and then immediately post that online as well. So yeah, you're spot on. It's literally this impossible, unattainable standard that people start to strive for.
Yeah.
And the other, you know, big problem with perfectionism is, like, it's totally subjective,
right?
Your idea of a perfect meal is probably very different from my idea of a perfect meal.
Yeah.
It's totally subjective. So you're never going to be perfect in everybody's eyes. Once again, it's literally unattainable.
Even within people, our standards change, right? What my perfect meal would have been as a 12-year-old is not like it is now, right? And so not only is it subjective between people, but within yourself, your preferences are going to change, what you prioritize as superior. And, you know, perfectionism too, in terms of my own experience with recovering perfectionism, was always performance-based. I was going to be a straight-A student. I was going to do things well. I was going to make sure there was minimal risk and maximum gain to the capacity that I could. And so perfectionism, of course, can take many different forms. And that's part of the complexity, right? Because it's not just a one or two-dimensional thing. There's so many different aspects to perfectionism.
Yeah, and that's one of many things that's been, like, really fascinating for me to learn more and more about over the years. We know within OCD, for example, there are all these different subtypes, all these different themes we've been able to identify over time. And it's actually the same thing for perfectionism with or without OCD. So you mentioned what we would call performance perfectionism. I've been a straight A student. I work with lots of people with social anxiety disorder. And the social anxiety really is driven by this fear. I have to appear perfect to others during any interaction I have with them.
Yeah.
The way I'm holding myself, the way I'm presenting myself, the way I'm speaking, the words I'm using, all that kind of stuff has to be perfect. Certainly if I'm giving some sort of presentation or some other kind of performance related situation, it all has to seem and feel perfect for the person. Otherwise, they're quick to fall into like this really harsh self-criticism, start to beat themselves up, start to assume others think poorly of them. So it can be really detrimental to someone's sense of self-worth. That is not uncommon, performance-based perfectionism.
And Taylor, you know, something I was just thinking about, and we were planning to talk about this and chatting a little bit before we started recording, but this is a different kind of approach to it. I'm thinking about for our autistic family that is listening, and sometimes even the pressure to mask to be able to fit in the stereotype. And this is a little bit what's even the basis of ABA therapy of you need to provide the right, perfect, quote-unquote, response. And so I'm thinking about for social anxiety, a lot of people's feeling and pressure, and this isn't all of social anxiety. I don't want to paint with a broad brush that this is what it is, this is what it equals. But it can bring up a lot of social anxiety for people that are like, hey, I have to muster up every ounce of energy that I possibly can to fit this idea of how I'm supposed to act, be, behave, etc. And it's exhausting. But also, again, it's not even necessarily their own defined mark for perfectionism. It is this performance that is expected. And that can be a really challenging piece, too, because we have different intersections where people do feel that need and survival for their own safety to push themselves into a certain mold. And so perfectionism sometimes comes from an inner expectation and sometimes can be also reinforced by different cultural expectations in terms of what it means to be successful or operate in an appropriate social manner or whatever the thing is. And so that complicates things as well.
Oh, definitely. And yeah, there are all these kind of like societal norms and those change over time as well. Certain cultural expectations. And as you're touching on, like, if those expectations don't really line up with who the person truly is, and they feel that pressure to come off a certain way, that of course, that's going to create a lot of internal dissonance, a lot of stress. I agree. It's completely and totally exhausting. And it kind of fosters this idea that there's something, quote unquote, wrong with them.
Right.
When there isn't.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So it's another kind of complex layer. And I like to be able to acknowledge that because it gets to be a messy conversation about perfectionism. But I love the imagery there, though, of that. And, you know, so as we speak to it, yes, there could be external factors that are reinforcing pieces of that perfectionism. And I'm sure we've all had experiences, whether it's our mom or our friend's mom, that was like, yes, you do have to do this well. And everyone's kind of reinforcing the accolades of certain performance or certain image or certain this, certain that. But today we are thinking about it. We're the OCD Family Podcast, so we're thinking about it within terms of OCD. But also one of the things that I think can be helpful for folks is just differentiating between what we would classify as ego dystonic versus egosyntonic forms of perfectionism. So just for any newer family joining us, my quick and dirty little like oversimplified definitions for egosyntonic and ego dystonic. Egosyntonic is something that's going to be more in sync. And I do think of the boy band, so judge if you must. But it's all kind of in lockstep. It's in sync with your value system. Ego dystonic is so distant from who you consider or see yourself to be or would ever want to be. Dystonic, again, somewhat of a clarifying understanding for what those words mean. And so when we think about perfectionism that shows up within OCD, as we learned, OCD is all about it being distant from who we want to be. It's very ego dystonic. But can we just even provide a little bit of clarification for folks in understanding? We're not painting perfectionism per se with a broad brush here, that there are, like we said, many different layers. And there are some forms of egosyntonic perfectionism that can show up for people too. And so if we could help sort that out for folks.
Yeah, I think a more egocentric take is that when there's this need, I would say, for things to seem perfect, or really maybe a better way to think of it is like things to be a certain way, the person truly believes that is important and that is the way it should be. And, you know, there is absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Right.
So my long-winded response is just, there can be some benefits to holding on to a perfectionistic belief system. In general, for people where the perfectionism is egocentric, they do tend to be highly successful people, right? They're driven, they're very motivated. One area where it might start to become a little bit problematic is, for example, if they're holding on to beliefs that things don't just need to be or feel a certain way for them, but if others should always be operating in a very specific perfectionistic manner. Other people are not doing that. That can create some conflict and stress in any kind of interpersonal relationships.
Sure.
But if the perfectionistic beliefs are egocentric and they're serving a constructive purpose for the person, meaning I have my set routine, I have my way I go about things, it's been very productive and helpful for me. Again, nothing wrong with that. What we see more with OCD is egodystonic manifestation, where it could be a thought, an image, an urge to have things be quote unquote perfect or feel just right. It doesn't quite line up with what the person actually thinks or actually believes. So if it helps to give like some examples with scrupulosity in OCD, it's one example. You might have someone with deeply held religious beliefs. They were following the guidelines of their religious practice. They are, by all accounts, a good citizen, care for others, that sort of thing. But they continue to get these doubts or intrusive thoughts that maybe they are not, quote unquote, perfect enough in their thoughts, right? Oh my God, I had a thought I don't like. Does that mean I'm impure in thought? Does that mean I'm imperfect? Have I done something wrong? And they start to attach a lot of meaning. Intrusive experiences. Or maybe they feel like they did not treat the other human being in the most perfect, appropriate manner. And then that's just a flood of more intrusive doubts and probably a lot of compulsions. So the person is behaving in a way that does line up with their values, but because of the OCD, they're going to continually doubt it and hold on to this idea that somehow, some way, they haven't done it well enough or perfectly. And then that continues to drive more anxiety and more urges for compulsions.
Yeah, and the perfectionism can also show up in that compulsion cycle where it feels like if that compulsion is not executed perfectly, that it's not effective. And then it feels like the stakes are so high and dire that it's like, well, this has to be executed perfectly. We also see perfectionism show up, at least I do, I conceptualize it this way, in sensory motor OCD, where it's that just right feeling, which again, talk about a moving target, and it's very subjective. You could do it the same way as you did yesterday, do an activity, but if it doesn't feel just right, then many people would describe the urging to complete or repeat the compulsion again until it does feel just right, because they're looking for ultimately even a sensory physiological experience where something needs to be perfected. And it can be incredibly distressing, as we know OCD to be, period. Because again, it is subject to change. It's subjective. As we just described, it doesn't have to be a meal from when I was 12 to now. It could be from me now to me an hour from now. And what does that mean? And so perfectionism is really, really tricky. And you have created this workbook and have done trainings to help people sort through this. And so can you give us a little bit of an inside strategy on how you address this with folks in treatment, or how you would even recommend for listeners going, yeah, my loved one's perfectionism, that thing you said about like now expecting me to do the same thing. Yeah, we're feeling that at home. So would love to have a broader conversation about that.
Well, certainly when perfectionism is living alongside OCD, exposure and response prevention does continue to be a very effective form of treatment with it. And that can take any number of forms when we're talking about people engaging in compulsions to try and achieve that feeling or that sense that it's perfect or just right, and then they can move on, kind of like you talked about. The response prevention piece would be whatever the compulsion is, can we find a way to have the person essentially stop themselves short of getting that perfect feeling and teaching themselves to just tolerate that feeling that something is incomplete or not quite right, and they're resolved to not go back and try and fix it in a manner then feel safe and perfect and that kind of stuff. So a quick example would be the person who is compulsively checking things and rereading, re-editing things. We see this a lot with OCD has all these different themes. There's so much overlap. What we might call something like responsibility OCD. Person's ongoing primary intrusive doubt is they're going to be responsible for something bad happening. I'm going to miss something really important. And it's going to have terrible, horrible repercussions, right? So as a result, you know, this looks like compulsions like retyping one email over and over and over again.
Right.
To make sure not just that there, you know, no spelling errors and it's all grammatically correct, but I want to make sure I've called the person by the correct name. I need to make sure there's nothing offensive in the text. Have I somehow thrown in like bad language that might put someone off? Right? Just doubt after doubt after doubt that something's off. It's not perfect. It's not quite right. So they're coming back to that process over and over and over again, re-editing, rereading, rechecking, maybe even after they've sent the email. They're coming back to their sent box and they're reading the email, even though it's already been sent. It's already out there, right? If you can identify a relatively clear compulsion like that, you would have the person actively practice doing it different. So can you do something like type up an email really quickly and just hit send, right? You're not even entirely sure what's in there. It's going to feel very incomplete. It's going to feel very imperfect and just see what happens, right? Along with that, we know with perfectionism and OCD, a lot of people are doing tons of mental review, viewing past interactions they've had with people, past conversations, events that may have happened 5, 10, 15 years ago. And it's this attempt to kind of check in retrospect, if I can just remember what happened perfectly, if I can remember every detail perfectly, then I can reassure myself that nothing bad happened and I didn't do anything wrong. But I have to remember it perfectly first. And people will stay in that kind of mentally compulsive process ad infinitum, truly.
Yeah. So, they're like for decades.
It happens. You know, it's unfortunate, but it happens. So point being, when we can identify anything that is compulsive, mental or physical, and it's this effort on the person's end to try and get that sense that things are perfect, they have 100% certainty, even just for a moment, that gives them that momentary sense of control, we're going to try and disrupt those kinds of behaviors.
Yeah.
I often say, you know, kind of half-kiddingly, it's a little bit fun as a therapist, but we're also being empathetic to the person trying this. We would encourage people to intentionally make mistakes, purposely do things incorrectly. Mm-hmm. And again, see what happens and see how well you tolerate that uncertainty and that discomfort associated with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure you've heard this feedback. I've heard this feedback and we've talked about this on the pod before, but a lot of folks, and it's not to delegitimize how distressing a behavioral ritual or a behavioral act can feel in terms of the OCD cycle. But a lot of people will come and say, but my brain, the mental review. How do you shut off the brain? And to the point that we're talking about, sometimes the goal changes, the goal mark changes. It can be subjective. How do you effectively do response prevention? I tend to see this through maybe a lens of solving compulsions. But for you, I'm sure you get this question a lot, and I'm sure you've addressed it even in the book. Folks struggle, you know, I can send the email and do the response prevention there. That's hard. It's hard. And so again, it's not delegitimizing how difficult that exposure could be. But folks get stuck on the response prevention when it has to do with mental reviewing, because they feel like, if I could have stopped thinking about it, I wouldn't be here, Taylor. We would not be having this conversation. I would just be like, moving on. Yeah, and so totally. What do you say to folks when they come to you and they're especially zoomed into the more mental acts or mental compulsion piece of this?
Yeah, I think being honest, and it's never to be discouraging, but just so everybody knows, like, managing mental compulsions is the hardest part of overcoming OCD. It's just the way it is, because quite frankly, our brain gets used to just kind of slipping into that process. It can become habitual. It can become automatic. So I always want to be crystal clear with people when we're talking about response prevention. I'm never going to sit here and tell you, like, oh, just don't think about that. Just stop it. Cut it out. Right. That doesn't work.
Right.
It doesn't work for anybody. The more you tell me to stop thinking about something, the more I'm actively thinking about it. Doesn't matter what it is. So I always try and take a very realistic approach. It is unlikely that the person is going to be able to prevent that mentally compulsive process before it starts. But if you can gain enough insight and awareness to recognize that it's happening and what it is that OCD is trying to achieve in that moment, once you recognize it's already occurring, you do have the power to disrupt it.
Yeah.
And I've seen people do it over and over and over again. It takes a lot of mental energy. It's like this intense mental workout, and it's very different probably from anything else the person's ever going to attempt in their life.
Right.
But with focus and energy, people can redirect their thought processes.
Yeah.
If they catch themselves mentally reviewing some past event, trying to check once again, make sure they got everything just right, it was all perfect, no one's upset with them, whatever it may be, right? Once they recognize that's occurring, can they find a way to just refocus on the doubt? Mm-hmm. This is what is often counterintuitive when we're doing ERP for OCD. We actually encourage people to refocus on the doubt and uncertainty as much as possible. So if the person can refocus on the unwanted idea, I might have gotten something wrong, I might have made a mistake, or even something as straightforward as it was imperfect, and just refocus on a singular statement like that over and over and over again, they do learn they can actually redirect their brain. They can pull themselves out of that mentally compulsive process, and all that discomfort around the initial doubt itself eventually starts to fade.
Yeah.
So it can totally be done.
Right.
Really can.
Are you a fan of doing something like a non-engagement response too as a response, which is a little bit different than just staying solely focused on it, but going like, there's nothing to do with it. Okay. The thought's here, but still, and I guess it depends probably on how people are reviewing or whatnot. We tend to talk about this a lot here in this community, but we want to focus on the function. And so if we find the function of how your compulsion, whether it's solving, so for me, it would be solving, then it's, Nicole, I don't have to do anything. I don't have to solve anything. That's my response prevention to that thought. If I'm going to say I don't need to engage with, did I make the mistake or not? There's nothing to solve. And it's not like the sexy answer, right? Because a lot of people are like, but I feel like I've been stuck on this thought for however many years. I can't just tell myself it's not going to solve. That's not going to do anything. But actually, it can do something. We can learn through the process, even a model like exposure and response prevention, that part of what gets these sticky, obsessive thoughts stuck is our response. And so actually creating new responses can create new learning in the brain.
Yeah. And to kind of build on that a little bit further, when the person is responding in a compulsive way, meaning they are trying to answer maybe an unanswerable question, they are trying to get some momentary certainty just to have some momentary relief. When their response is in a way that they're actually trying to get away from the unwanted thought or idea, they're treating that thought as a threat in their own brain. And therefore, the next time that same doubt or a very similar one comes into the brain, it's going to feel risky. It's going to feel threatening and scary again.
Yeah.
So I think non-engagement responses are great. It always depends on the individual.
Right.
But if you have someone who can recognize, once again, they're slipping into some sort of mentally compulsive process, and they can remind themselves of what they would prefer to be doing, that can be a constructive way to kind of manage it as well. I've also had people that are able to come up with a non-engagement response that is just very factual. So one I'm working with currently, when she catches herself doing a bunch of mental review and recognizes that's what's going on and she's just trying to get some momentary relief, she is able to use the response of no amount of analyzing this is ever going to be enough. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's true. It's never enough for the OCD. So she's able to recognize in a moment, I could do this for years. I could do this for the rest of my life. It would never be enough. So why do it right now? Everybody's a little bit different. And I do think it's really important that when I'm working with people, it's always collaborative. I'm always asking them, like, what is something you could try and focus on? What is something you could try and remind yourself of that will actually increase your chances of getting out of that compulsive process?
Yeah, it's a really good point. Somebody who has done a lot in terms of building upon research, it's not evidence-based practice in and of itself, but it is on the backs of a lot of research that's been done, is Dr. Michael Greenberg around rumination-focused ERP. So it's not quite the traditional ERP that we're discussing right now, but he talks about awareness versus engagement. It is oversimplification of Dr. Greenberg's work. But he talks about awareness over engagement. And so if you think about it in terms of mental review, even you may have the mental review of the conversation that you had 15 years ago, but you can also look around even your physical space. I'm looking around mine right now, and there's a number of things that we're aware of that exist that we're not wasting a second thought on. We're not engaging in thought around. And so I've found, especially we've had Michael on the podcast, and a lot of people have found his work particular. It's one of my more engaged episodes around his idea with rumination, because rumination is a form of this mental review that can be really, really challenging. And so I know at NOCD, ERP, and again, that's exposure and response prevention, is the main modality. But is there room for something like RFERP in terms of augmenting the traditional ERP practice? I don't know the inner workings over there, so I wasn't sure.
Well, my ongoing annoying answer is it always depends on the individual.
Yeah,
it really, truly does. And one of the things I personally have really enjoyed about continuing to do ERP over the years is, first of all, I do see it be highly effective. It works for the vast majority of people. It is also a highly individualized form of treatment. We are helping people identify their specific obsessions and their specific obsessive fears. Being very thorough, helping them understand anything and everything they're doing that might constitute a compulsion. And we're addressing each of those things one by one. So I'll say this, I've seen a good chunk of people going through, I guess, what we would call this kind of traditional classic ERP. Mm-hmm. It's literally focused on making an effort to resist compulsive urges until some sort of decrease in their anxiety occurs, or they show themselves, I can tolerate this ongoing level of distress without doing anything about it. I've seen enough people doing kind of that classic ERP where they get to that kind of natural new learning, where they have that state of awareness you're talking about. And they are in a moment be able to observe, oh, that's a mentally compulsive process. I literally don't need to do that right now. What else is around me that I could focus? Some people will kind of get to that point just through doing straightforward ERP. Other people won't. And at that point, yeah, we look at what are some other methods we could start to incorporate with the individual, right? I know there are people that maybe they've tried ERP for a very long time. They've had some progress, some efficacy, but they're not quite to the point they want. And then they try a modality through a different lens, something like ICBT. And then all of a sudden that ends up being the game changer, right? Mm-hmm. Or vice versa. My long-winded and sometimes frustrating answer is it really, truly depends on the individual. I don't think you could ever take like a one-size-fits-all approach when you're trying to help someone learn how to manage OCD.
I absolutely agree. I mean, short of a cure, if we had a cure then and it was eradicated, then yes, there was a one-size-fits-all.
Right. It's a good job, but I would find something else to do. That'd be fine.
Appear to be out of a job if OCD was not a thing. But perfectionism would still be a thing. So you would still have somewhat of a job, I know. But yeah, no, it's a great point. One of the things too, and I'm just thinking of a particular client that has contamination OCD disgust based.
and some of the perfectionistic qualities of the compulsions because of that fear of getting exposed to a disgust-based contaminant. With disgust-based, it's a little trickier because how disgust functions and responds in the brain, it is different than how anxiety responds in the brain. And so I know that there's been some research that has shown disgust having a harder time responding sometimes to ERP. However, one of the things you were describing, and I think is worth noting for folks listening, is that some of the awarenesses that we can come to through the process of realizing, oh my gosh, I'm in a compulsive cycle that isn't serving me, that is problematic. Sometimes those awarenesses in and of themselves, whether we can explain it or not, make a cosmic shift in how our OCD functions and can bring a lot of relief for folks. But I will hear this a lot from disgust clients or people with lived experience that have experience with disgust. The fear is, and you were kind of talking about it even in general with the avoidance example, but the fear is if I get started on this, if I get exposed to this, I'm never going to feel this sense of clean again or this sense of non-contamination, right? And so it creates the bubble where they really have to feel like things are perfectly executed. It reinforces that perfectionism because I can't risk this all starting or I might never rid myself of this feeling. I see this show up too in emetophobia, which is second cousin here to OCD. If I get to that point, I can't even let myself get to this point, right? Because I'm not going to be able to handle it. And it creates the behavioral manifesto, really, that things have to be executed to perfection as a protective measure. And so when it comes to disgust, and that does get a bit tricky, how do you help manage and how do you help address something like the perfectionism element of that? Because it is a bit complex in how it functions versus just your run-of-the-mill. And again, not to delegitimize people with anxious, I'm like, this is not a cakewalk over here.
So when I'm working with kind of that disgust-based feeling, really, it's really continuing to drive the behaviors. I'm looking at a few different things. Always important, you mentioned like understanding the function of any behavior, right? What is the person hoping to accomplish by getting a compulsive process perfect? You ask that question and you'll get a wide range of answers. But a very, very common answer is that I will finally feel okay. Mm-hmm. So disgust can be tricky. But at the end of the day, the way I've always kind of viewed it is the person is still trying to achieve a certain feeling.
Right.
People can stay stuck in that cycle with or without OCD, again, forever.
Right.
Right. So believe it or not, more often than not, when I'm working with people who are talking about this disgust, and I agree with you, like I work with people who talk about disgust, they're never using words like anxiety or stress. It's all about the disgust. There is that belief they formed over time. I can't feel this way. I'm not supposed to feel this way. I should never feel this way. And like you also alluded to, I'm afraid I'm going to feel like this forever and I simply can't handle it. So I really look at once again, what are they trying to accomplish by going through their compulsions in a perfect order, perfect manner, whatever it may be. And again, if it's trying to achieve that perfect feeling, having them try to learn to better tolerate and sit with the discomfort, not feeling exactly the way they would like to all the time.
Yeah. If we're in a constant effort to emotionally sanitize a situation, then also we're incredibly vulnerable because we have no ability. You know, I was talking with Dr. Melissa Hunt about this, even in terms of it was really fascinating how the GI tract and everything connects and is impacted and how lack of exposure is going to really impact then our ability to tolerate the world at large, right? But if we think about this even on an emotional level, if we are trying to zap out any kind of feeling or sensation and we're rating any kind of movement on that as maybe a failure in terms of perfectionism language, which failure for people who know me personally, that's the F word in our house. We're like, no, we're not going to failure here. But it can get really, really tricky. And so even having people be able to practice, like you said, sitting and focusing on those harder feelings. Again, how the brain learns around disgust might be a little different, but if you can even address that emotional or sensory-motor piece of, I need to have a just right feeling with this, and going, okay, but what if you don't have to have a just right feeling with this, and being able to address kind of sitting with that can be a route for doing something like response prevention. So in terms of the book that you wrote, who can benefit from this the most? Yes, a person with a lived experience of OCD could probably benefit from it big time, but generally, who can benefit and what age bracket even, if it could work with kiddos or if it's more for a certain developmental level and above? Would love to hear more about that.
As far as age brackets go, I mean, you could start working on this stuff at any age, and it would probably be more impactful for, you know, a kid, someone in early adolescence, to actively see on a day-to-day basis. They can mess stuff up. They can feel off and not quite right. They may not dress perfectly how their friends do and all that kind of stuff. And day in and day out, they can handle it. And it actually doesn't have like this super negative impact on their day-to-day lives. So my mindset has always been, the younger we can catch this stuff, the better. People up for success from an early age, so it'll be easier to manage as they go through life. But as we kind of mentioned at the beginning, I'm always looking for, like, when have perfectionistic beliefs and the behaviors that follow that belief system, when have they become problematic for the person? And bottom line, that it's actually causing more harm than good. Meaning, is it causing ongoing stress or flat out distress on a day-to-day basis? Are they in fear of not having things be or seem or feel perfect? And is that essentially driving their decision-making and, again, driving their behaviors? So in the book, I reference a bunch of different case examples. I don't flat out say it in the workbook, but all of those case examples were people living with OCD. So what we tend to look at, again, is, have things gotten to a point in the person's life where their perfectionistic beliefs and behaviors are interfering with their ability to maintain healthy interpersonal relationships, friends, family, even like colleagues in school, people at work? Have their perfectionistic fears about not always presenting themselves in an ideal manner, has that caused more withdrawal, more isolation? Is it now contributing to depression? Are people having so much difficulty coping with their perceived imperfections that they are, in fact, turning to things like substance abuse? Mm-hmm. Eating disorders, is the person so focused on having the quote-unquote perfect body that they are literally causing themselves damage by their eating behaviors? These are more extreme examples, but honestly, just using myself as an example, I'm kind of an open book. Like, I've never met criteria for any psychiatric disorder or anything like that. But my perfectionism manifested in a way that throughout my academic career, I was more stressed than not, more days than not. And what I like to share about my experience, because I never would have guessed this is perfectionism, because it kind of took a different form, was I was engaging in tons of procrastination and avoidance. And what we see a lot with perfectionism is, you know, there are these stereotypes around it, just as there are with everything, right? But most people kind of equate perfectionism with like the type A personality, the overachiever, alcoholic, and that kind of stuff. And perfectionistic beliefs can drive all those behaviors. But there is this flip side of perfectionism, and this was my lived experience, where just the idea of something like working on a paper for college, right? Just the idea of it, I knew it would be fraught with so much unrest and stress because I wanted to get it perfect that in a moment it felt easier to just put it off. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, as a 19, 20, 21-year-old kid, I knew enough, never knew it was perfectionism, but I knew enough to know, once I start that process, it's going to be miserable for me.
Yeah.
I'm going to hate it because I'm going to be so worried every second that I'm not getting it perfect. Mm-hmm. And the outcome, the result, will not be perfect. And I'm not going to get that A+. And my teacher's going to think I'm an idiot. And then maybe I should drop out of college and I would just start catastrophizing. That whole prospect was so uncomfortable. I would just put it off until I had no choice.
Right.
And it was at the last second. And then I'm pulling in an all-nighter, which was also miserable.
Right.
And then what I realized, this was many years later when I was going through my own therapy, what I realized in retrospect was by doing that, then I kind of had a built-in excuse. Meaning when I got the paper back and I didn't get the A+, and it wasn't perfect, my fallback was, well, I didn't have enough time. Mm-hmm. I had totally done it to myself.
Right.
And as a result, I mean, I made a lot of great friends in college. Overall, I had a good time in college. Mm-hmm. But the academic piece was really unpleasant. Mm-hmm. Same thing when I was in grad school. And that was when I was finally like, I got to do something about this. I have to change the way I'm operating here. Because the more I was procrastinating and avoiding and putting stuff off, that anticipatory anxiety and that stress was just building up more and more and more. And it was all out of a fear that I wasn't going to get it just right.
Yeah.
So recognize, again, the way people are perceiving things and kind of this perceived need to be perfect and perform perfectly, when we can see it causing that kind of disruption, that's where I think it's important to address.
Yeah, it's a really good and interesting point. And, you know, it makes me think, too, of some of the information campaigns going out, even for some of the neurodivergent population, ADHD, autistic folks, thinking about the amount of energy they tend to put it in terms of how much it's going to expel from them. So it's not always about perfectionism, but even for a task that's going to lead to a pleasurable outcome, the amount of effort that it's going to take to put in can sometimes be stalling or procrastinate the start of even initiating that task because, oh my gosh, the amount of energy it's going to take to finish that task. And so certainly we can see perfectionism, again, in every direction showing up. And so if you feel like, yes, and on top of that, the pressure of the execution has to be just right. And what's just right mean for today? What's just right mean? It is a very, very relatable and problematic struggle that people are facing. So it's not unique to OCD. It absolutely shows up in OCD, and not for everyone, but for a lot of people. But it shows up in a lot of different facets of life. One of the conversations we had, one of the first times we connected, I asked you about this because I see this show up a lot in relationship OCD. I think it really boils down to, did I pick a perfect partner or relationship or did I not? Do I need to go find the perfect partner or relationship? And the reality is, what's the perfect partner and relationship? Guess what, honey? It ain't you. Look in the mirror and it's not going to be your spouse or your partner because perfect doesn't exist, right?
Right.
And yeah. So I see perfectionism show up in a big way in relationship OCD, and that can be between intimate partners, but that can also be at times between, say, parent-child, or it can be between someone's higher power and themselves. And so it gets tricky.
Oh, it's very, very tricky, and I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, more often than not, when we think of relationship OCD, we're usually thinking about romantic relationships, intimate relationships. There is such a thing as romantic perfectionism that kind of ties into that. But I couldn't agree more. We see relationship OCD actually negatively impacting any kind of relationship. So just like thinking about the romantic perfectionism piece of things, that is certainly something that has been influenced by life. Think about all these. My wife loves romantic comedies, but movie after movie, they're really purporting these unrealistic ideas of what romance and love is and how a committed relationship should be. And it's all magical and wonderful in the movie and in books, right? And it's fun when you indulge in that as a fantasy, but it becomes problematic when people start to form this idea, oh, that's how my relationships are supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And then with a relationship OCD, the ego dystonic part is usually, whatever relationship it is, some part of the person's brain knows it's a great relationship. Actually, I have a great relationship with my mom. I have a great relationship with my kid. My best friend has been my best friend for 15 years. But then the ego dystonic part is, But what if it's not enough? What if it's not good enough? What if I've missed something and somehow I'm going to actually end up hurting that person? So I don't know what you've seen. I can tell you 9 times out of 10 with a relationship OCD, the fear and doubt boils down to the person is afraid they're getting something wrong. Once again, they're missing something, making some sort of mistake, and that could wind up actually causing harm to the person they care about, including emotional harm.
Yeah.
So that fosters this idea like things have to feel perfect and great all the time. And I often share this example. This is a woman I worked with years and years ago. Brilliant young woman, almost what we would call like textbook classic relationship OCD. She told me at the outset of therapy that her belief was that she should feel 100% complete and total passion for her partner 24/7. That was her. Any moment of the day when she was not feeling quote unquote 100% complete and total passion towards her partner, so all these doubts, right?
Sure.
What if I don't love him enough? What if he's not the right, you know, maybe I should be with someone else. Should I actively look for someone else? I'm going to wind up hurting them if I stay in this relationship another day. So even, you know, with ERP, right, we're doing all this behavioral work, working on compulsions, but I had to challenge that belief she had developed.
Yeah.
Right? Like, what is, can you even describe to me what 100% complete and total passion is? Like what that feels like? And how is it realistic to any degree to feel any feeling, any emotion 100% of the time? So again, literally impossible.
It sounds
literally
exhausting impossible. Too.
Exhausting.
Very exhausting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think within families, you know, there could be a disagreement, which is very, very natural, right? There could be something like a relatively normal, for lack of a better word, disagreement. And then the person with any kind of relationship perfectionism or relationship OCD starts to catastrophize and fear what that means.
Yeah.
Right? The other thing we see kind of with or without OCD, and this is, you know, this can happen totally inadvertently, like, as parents, like I know I do this as a parent, we communicate things that we're not fully thinking about as far as like how people should feel, things about like how they should be doing, like with their friends, how they should be doing in school and sports and with the creative things, right? And I used to catch myself doing this all the time when my kids were younger, like telling them like, oh, like just cheer up. Oh, don't worry about it. Like literally saying things like, don't feel bad about that. I'm telling my kid like how they should or should not feel in a moment. Pretty innocent, certainly wasn't intentional on my end. And then I started to realize this is the kind of stuff that over time can lead to things like emotional perfectionism.
Right. Well, and so many of, so my kids, just for context, Taylor, are all autistic. So I think of the autistic community quite a bit, and we have quite a few autistic listeners, but they have, even from a sensory experience, it's not too loud, it's not too bright, it's not too this, it's not too cold. And people don't have ill intention generally. They're not even thinking about it generally. I mean, there's some assholes out there that are being assholes, but generally most people are good and they're not trying to delegitimize your experience. But you start to collect that feedback over time, yes, and it can set up this premise that there's a right way to feel things and a wrong way to feel things. And especially when we think about the OCD population, the black and white thinking of it's either all good or all bad, it's scary, dire thing, or it's not, you know, it makes the waters very murky there. One of the things you were talking about that's topically relevant, we are recording this prior to here in the U.S. You may have heard of it. There's an election coming up. And as you were describing some of the philosophy even and complexities around relationship OCD, and one thing that I don't hear talked about a lot, but I think is very relevant, is even in the ideology politically, and this isn't saying like people can stand wherever they stand, but we see how polarized things are in this day and age. And we start to go, yeah, there are some lines in the sand, even at our own dinner tables, of if you could even conceive processing the world in this way, that's wrong. You're wrong. And again, similar to the temperature in the room or you cheer up or whatever, you know, again, I think people are coming at it with intentions and strong convictions. But I can see how that perfectionism, and even for us with lived experience of OCD, which I have lived experience of OCD, subclinical at this point, but lived experience, how even the political culture wars can become rife with this idea of perfectionism, and there is one right way to conceive things, and you are the big, bad, terrible something if you think about it a different way.
Yeah. And that's such an excellent and also kind of a painful example, truly, of like that larger societal influence on the way we think and these ideas we form about ourselves and the world around us certainly influences the way we behave. But you're right. I mean, what is highlighted the most in society are extreme viewpoints. That's what we tend to hear about the most.
Right.
And like you said, like, and that's usually polar opposites. And over time, it does foster this kind of a larger belief. There is one right and there is one wrong. It is very all or nothing thinking, very black or white thinking. And again, it's not how the world actually works, right? The world is really like this huge gray area.
Yeah.
Right? There isn't always one right best way. And as far as like what is right versus what is wrong, by and large, that's pretty subjective as well. Right. There are a few exceptions to that, but it is based on like subjective viewpoints. It's based on our own opinions. But I think just how this kind of trickles down and bringing it back to perfectionism, people start to form this idea. There's a right way, one right way to be, and anything that's not that is wrong. What we hear a lot with perfectionism and OCD is like, if it's not perfect, it's a complete and total failure. If I'm not perfect, then I'm a complete and total failure.
Right.
And that's, to me, that's just so limiting. It's so limiting. How are there two options for you at any given point in your life? It's so limiting.
Right. Yeah. And just at the beginning of our chat, then you were talking about when something transcends, then not only beyond your ability to kind of think what's right for you, or something has to be perfect enough for you, but also holding then the people around you to that same standard. And so much of, you know, it could be, go on social media, it could be about deodorant, and it could be like, what's wrong with you that you would choose this deodorant and this or that? And the trolling comments and scathing remarks about how you shouldn't spawn and reproduce because you are what's wrong in the world because you chose this deodorant. And that's a mild example. Yes, there are a lot bigger conversation topics on the table there. And so if this is the dynamic, this is the environment, this is the fishbowl between augmented reality and image and different very, very strong convictions. And I'm not saying don't have convictions, folks, but, you know, in terms of there's one right way, some of the flexibility in our thinking, some of the need there is to be able to understand that there isn't just one right way, or there could probably even if you're doing something perfect, something could be perfected upon. It's not that this is the pinnacle, kingpin, this is the bar we need to achieve. There's always, you know, I think about this in terms of relationship OCD, there's always going to be a more perfect relationship out there, and there's always going to be a worse relationship out there, and there's going to be a better partner or a better whatever. And you could be a better partner or whatever. Like, you're not the greatest thing since sliced bread either. Because we all have our flaws. And being able to take it back to even to that definition you used in the beginning. What is flawless? It doesn't exist, people. It doesn't. Nothing is flawless. Which was, I'm sure, a hard pill to swallow for your client that came in saying 100% passion, nothing less. But how life-giving, how freeing on the flip side of that coin when you realize actually nothing is that and I don't have to attain or seek or find that. Like, actually, it's so freeing to come out of that cage because, like you said, it can be so limiting, this construct of what things need to be or should be or must be, and it just doesn't exist. Perfectionism does not exist. And so it sounds like, family, if you're following along with us, that anybody could really benefit from looking into these different exercises and examples and learning from this perfectionism workbook. And so it's available on Amazon. Is it also available on Kindle and Audible?
All that kind of good stuff. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. So I'm going to have all of that information linked over on this episode's blog at OCDFamilyPodcast.com.
Also, you have the Chicago Counseling Center in the Chicagoland area. So if people are in Illinois, and I'm guessing via telehealth or in person, if people want to check out services through Taylor's practice, he sees clients there. He has an amazing staff that was working. I was telling Taylor I met half his staff at the OCD walk in Chicago. And somebody that the pod is more familiar with, we've had Madison on the show many times. Madison is one of your stellar therapists over there. And so it's definitely worth checking out. All that's going to be linked on the blog. But as we wrap up today, Taylor, anything else you would want to impart to the fam?
I would just say, with everything we're talking about, like, it's all way more common than anybody might guess. And for anybody, whether it's for yourself, or you have a loved one that you're seeing display these perfectionistic tendencies, it can all be worked on in a way that, like you said, is in fact freeing. Mm-hmm. When the person is able to actually see, oh, I don't have to view things in terms of absolutes. I don't have to drive myself to these behaviors that are actually causing me more distress and more disruption. It can be very freeing. It can all be worked on, truly.
I love that. And also, we'll give one last nod to NoCD. You do training and support through NoCD. You also see clients even through NoCD. And so, again, if you want to tell folks a little bit more about NoCD, and if you know, because last I've talked with somebody from NoCD, I know it's ever expanding in terms of its reach, different countries, et cetera. And so it's not just U.S.-based, but it is U.S.-based as well, all 50 states and territories. And so if you can let folks know a little more about NoCD, if they want to learn more about that, we'd love to hear it.
Yeah, so NoCD has quickly grown to be the world's largest telehealth provider that provides specialized treatment for OCD. I shouldn't say just for OCD. It's always primary focus, but we also work with people living with different kinds of anxiety disorders, body focus, repetitive behaviors, all the things we see, you know, commonly living in OCD. But yeah, we now provide services across all 50 states, Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, and a few other countries around the world. What's been awesome about my work there is I'm their director of clinical training. I've had the opportunity to train hundreds and hundreds of therapists to help them understand the nuances and the challenges that go along with living with OCD, and best of all, how to provide effective treatment for it.
That's awesome. Yeah. And you do not have to work for or be a part of NoCD's direct community to benefit. So if you're a therapist, like, I don't work for NoCD, I was able to attend a training. And so I'm sure there's the internal trainings versus the community trainings, but it's a great resource to be able to get some continuing education if you're a therapist. And is NoCD accredited for both the psychologist level and we're getting into talking shop on CEs, the type of CEs, but that's good, right? Because not everybody is doing the APA credits and things like that. So,
yeah, so tons of free CEs. We offer usually at least one up to three live free CE courses every month. We have lots of home study CE courses. On top of that, just for the general public, we have multiple webinars we offer on a weekly basis. A lot of them are just open Q&As, meaning anybody from anywhere, someone living with OCD, a family member, a loved one, they can pop in and ask any and all questions they have of an OCD specialist. Got a great online community just through the NoCD app that's completely free to the public as well. So lots of great support available through them.
Yeah. And I like the NoCD app too. I would always suggest, if you're new to ERP, exposure and response prevention, or OCD treatment, having that guided by a therapist is going to be so, so helpful. But I love that NoCD also has built into their app an ability to track exposures, or even coming up with ideas for exposures, because I think the harder part of ERP treatment for a lot of people, even some clinicians, that's right, I'm calling you out because I've been there, I've been you at a point in time, is getting the response prevention, like actually practicing the response prevention. So having that guidance from a therapist is going to be really, really helpful. But also in the app, I love that you can build exposures in there. It can give you some ideas. You can give it some content that you're struggling with it, and it can help customize an exposure, what that would be for you. And so I think that's really helpful. Lots of really great tools there available through NoCD. Well, Taylor, this has been fantastic. You're so busy between all the training, and you're seeing clients in Chicago, you're seeing clients through NoCD. I don't know Hopefully you haven't felt the pressure to perfect that and you have some downtime yourself.
You know what? I will say that has actually put me in a position where, like, really, truly, I'm able to see there's no way to get it all perfect.
Yeah.
Multiple jobs. I've got 3 kids. It's never going to be perfect. And you know what? No worries. It actually feels so much better knowing I'm never going to get it all right.
Right. Oh, it's freeing. There's so much freedom in that. Well, I appreciate your time. Thanks for coming and hanging out with the fam. And we look forward to hearing more. I'm sure we will continue to see great things from you, Taylor. So thank you again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Intrusive thoughts. All righty, fam. All right. What did you think, huh? There's plenty to chew on from that conversation, but I'll tell you something that struck me when I was prepping our interview for today. We mentioned politics and how there was going to be an election, not knowing, particularly because it wasn't planned for this episode to publish on the bookend of Inauguration Week. Talk about irony. And fam, I've said it before, but it never hurts to mention again, or for any newer family joining, I don't get into political conversations on the pod. It's not because I don't have feelings or you don't have feelings. I'm sure it's quite the contrary. But there are so many places or spaces where you could go for political commentary, and there are so few places where we can support our OCD warriors. So it's very intentional that I protect and maintain focus on the OCD family community. But this brings us to today's intrusive thought segment, which is the application segment of my show for any newer family joining. It's where we try to put into practice something we've heard or learned about today, whether we are a family member, a warrior, a practitioner, or heck, all three. And so I want to go back to one of the tips Taylor had for combating perfectionism, or even the compulsive process more broadly. And that has to do with refocusing on the doubt. And while this is certainly a helpful exercise for people with OCD, it's helpful for anyone battling perfectionism too. So Taylor mentioned earlier that he asks questions like, what is something you could try and focus on? What is something you could try and remind yourself of? And this is where we get to flip the script, family. So instead of, if I just work a little bit longer, this could be better, it can improve, maybe if I do it again. Instead of perfection, we can flip that script to, no matter how long I work on this, perfection is an unattainable goal. Just like French philosopher Voltaire espoused, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Or a thought like, no matter how much I think about something or try something, it won't be enough. Because as crushing as it might sound to a perfectionist, that's actually where freedom is born. You can still do a really, really good job. You can still care so much. And there's no such thing as perfect. And thank goodness, am I right? Because getting out of our heads and into our lives is one of the best gifts of all. So try answering the question for yourself. Maybe stick a post-it or write a message on your mirror. Keep a note by your phone charger, because Lord knows we cross paths with that thing more than we care to admit. And leave yourself an affirmation that focuses on your doubt. For me, I think mine would read something like, I'm not perfect, I'm not perfect, and I'm not sorry about it. Because so often, I am trying to make up for the gap that my humanity creates. What's yours? Because no matter what you doubt, fam, you're not alone. And we are better together. Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the download on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family like Taylor and me chatting imperfectly. That's right, I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. Therapists, are your clients struggling with disgust-based contamination OCD? Have you tried upgrading your ERP with the Mastery approach? Visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses and click on my link, because I've got just the training for you. At OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses, you can check out OCD Training School's entire catalog of courses, including Rich Gallagher's course, Treating Contamination OCD. Where else can you build mastery over disgust-based triggers while supporting the fam at no extra cost to you? It's a win-win at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses.